Hi, folks. Sam Cedar here. Excuse me one second. Could you pass the mashed potatoes, please? Thank you. Hi, folks. Sam Cedar here. I am pretending to have Thanksgiving dinner right now, so I will not be recording a show today. But let me wish you all a happy Thanksgiving and tell you that we've got a great, great show from our archives. David Cross, guest hosting with me on the Majority Report from April of 2005. Our guest is the late Chalmers Johnson, who just passed on this week, a brilliant thinker and writer. I know you'll enjoy. You'll also recognize the voice of the news guru, Bill Crowley, if you are a fan of the Majority Report. And I also, coincidentally, on that same very night, I made a prank phone call of sorts to Tom DeLay's office to ask about the calls for his resignation for a growing scandal that just led to his conviction on Wednesday of this week. And so, Tom DeLay, bye-bye. All right, enjoy this, folks, and we'll have a new podcast up for you tomorrow. It'll be an archive of some of the book shows I did for Cedar on Sundays. And then we'll be live on Monday. Enjoy and happy Thanksgiving. I hope your family has had safe travels and a lot of fun.
Now, let's talk about this Tom DeLay.
Good old Tom DeLay.
The guy is...
He's not George's pal, though. Did you hear that?
Yes. Well, this is very funny, actually, because...
It's over now.
They work friends.
Well,
they're not social.
We actually have some audio of this.
It's like they did with Trent Lott. They're cutting him loose. You know?
Let me read. This is from yesterday, and I read this story yesterday. White House supportive of embattled DeLay. McClellan was asked if Bush was among those who believed that the embattled Texas Republican should resign. And McClellan said, Majority Leader DeLay is someone the president considers a friend, and he is someone he has worked closely with to get things done in Washington. The president looks forward to continue to work closely with the majority leader to get things done on behalf of the American people. Let's listen to what he said today.
Well, on the record, then, the president has reviewed the allegations against Leader DeLay, and he's completely confident that Tom DeLay is clean and can lead the Republican.
Well, he was asked this question in a press conference just a couple of weeks ago. He made his views known when it comes to Leader DeLay. That remains his view. And in terms of those matters, I mean, I think I previously talked about that those are issues that will be addressed by the congressional leaders and by Leader DeLay.
You said a couple days ago that, as the president said, he considers Tom DeLay a friend. I actually went back. I never saw the president say that anywhere. He said he had confidence in Tom DeLay. And I also noticed that Tom DeLay said, when the president was running for president in 2000 or 1999, that Bush was not a social friend of his. So does Bush consider...
There are a number of congressional leaders that he works closely with on the Hill, and he considers a friend, sure.
And he considers Tom DeLay a friend?
Sure. I mean, I think there are different levels of friendship in with anybody. So. Well, no, you referred to social friends, but no, he certainly is a friend.
Certainly is.
There you go,
folks. There's different kinds of friends.
Different levels of friends. Now,
there's your sleepover friends. There's your confidant friends. You know, there's your Valentine's kind of buddy.
There's your work friend.
Your special, bring him down to the...
You only see him at work.
To the...
I love it. In his administration, first the Senate, then the House. This is great.
What's
the
that?
The leaders having to resign.
That's well... Listen, I'll tell you something. They took out Trent Lott. I mean, the Bush administration took out Trent Lott. They didn't like Trent Lott.
They planted those words in his mouth, is what you're saying.
No, I'm saying...
No, but they used that as the pretext.
They used that as the pretext. I mean, listen, you could probably find Trent Lott have
they didn't
had
fight
said that
very
stuff
hard
in the past
for
10 years. And they were waiting for something, and they found it. I mean, you can find something on anybody if you want. Of course, you could never get the wealth of riches that Tom DeLay provides, because he is so ethically challenged. It is unbelievable. Nancy Pelosi came out with a great statement yesterday, or I guess it was today, basically taking him for task, saying, you know, when the Contract for America came in, Tom DeLay was talking about ethics are the most important thing in the world.
Oh, there's tons of those quotes where
In 89, Tom DeLay said...
Those were Democratic ethics, though.
That's right.
Those were Democratic members of Congress.
In 1989, DeLay says, the Government Ethics Reform Act will strengthen and clarify existing House rules, issues such as the ban on congressional honoraria, limits on gifts and travel, increased financial disclosure, restriction on outside income, and conflict of interest rules will be tightened to reflect the growing and changing role of government service. I am especially pleased to support this comprehensive overhaul of health ethics rules and conflict of interest rules because it's an important first step in enhancing the ethical standards throughout government and adjusting compensation for individuals whose skills are essential to the quality of service government provides to the American people. It is my hope that honor will be restored to elected offices so that we can continue to work for the values we have fought for in the past with quality representation in the future. And we got Republicans calling us up and saying, he didn't do anything legally wrong. Mm-hmm. What are you talking about? And now, Bill, what was that story you said last night? He went to the Senate, right, to say...
They had a breakfast meeting, and basically it was telling the senators what to say when they're asked about the delay ethics difficulties. And he said basically two things, blame the Democrats blame the media.
Yeah.
And
this was just yesterday, right?
Yeah.
And if you listen to Rush Limbaugh, if you see happened to see Scarborough last night, it's all the New York Times. Apparently only the New York Times is the one that's talking about delay. They don't mention the fact that the Wall Street Journal, perhaps the most single conservative national paper in the country, came out against delay even before this latest round of charges against him, about $500,000 to his wife and to his daughter, about going to Russia paid for by lobbyists, about everything. I mean, this guy is so dirty. Now, I made a phone call because it wasn't just the Wall Street Journal. It was papers across the country.
Financial Times did, too, I believe.
But that's British.
Well, still.
Yeah, there you go. Well, there are papers all around the country in the reddest of the red states that had something to say about Tom DeLay. And I called Tom DeLay's office to find out what they said about it. It's number 9.
Office of Congressman DeLay?
Yeah, hi. This is Sam Cedar calling from the Majority Report. I was trying to see if who the person would be to give me a comment on the Lincoln, Nebraska's Journal Star, which called for Congressman DeLay's resignation.
That'd be Shannon Flaherty or Dan Allen.
Okay. And would they also be able to tell me about the Louisville, Kentucky Courier Journal calling for the resignation as well?
They do everything that has to do with the press. They're the press secretary and deputy press secretary.
Okay, is it a regional thing? Because also I want to ask them about the Montgomery, Alabama, and the Virginia News Leader, too.
They do everything with press.
Are they just in charge of the calls for resignation or everything?
They're the press. They do all the press.
I hope they're not getting paid by the hour for that one.
I don't know. They don't. We're not hourly paid.
Can I just ask you, are people at the office, you know, getting their resumes out? Because also the New Jersey Bergen Herald came out, too.
Do you need the phone number to get a hold of them, or...?
So people are around your office, though. You don't see anybody, like, getting their resumes out or anything like that.
The press secretary can handle that. Any questions you might have?
Can you cough if people are... Can you give me, like, two coughs if people are checking out their resumes?
Huh. Interesting.
Yeah, now, so they're having to deal with papers across the country now are calling for Tom DeLay's resignation. And even Newt Gingrich... Right? Even Newt Gingrich said that you can't go around blaming the Democrats. What did he say? Do we have it? Let's play him before we go out. Newt Gingrich, this is him on CNN.
No, we don't have that.
What?
But what he did say was his problem is not with the Democrats.
He's saying, when you're being attacked, the first thing you naturally do is describe your attackers. In this case, that won't work. DeLay's problem isn't with the Democrats. DeLay's problem is with the country. And so DeLay has a challenge, I think, to lay out a case that the country comes to believe that the country decides is legitimate. If he does that, he's fine. Good luck, Tom DeLay.
It's gotten to the point where he's become a liability, and that's when the Republicans start eating their own. And that's the only reason they do it.
Right.
That's the
reason
they do it, is because he's a liability. So, and level of hypocrisy can't be ignored anymore.
I wonder what Newt's motivations are. Maybe there was some bad history when Newt himself was shown the door.
Could be, but it also could coincide with his upcoming scheduled trips to New Hampshire and Iowa,
yes.
Which is a fact.
Thinking about running for president,
New Hampshire and Iowa. What do they have in common?
They both have eyes in there.
They both have awesome state fairs.
All right, Bill Crowley, thank you very much. When we come back, we're going to be talking to Chalmers Johnson. He is the president of the Japan Policy Research Institute, professor emeritus at the University of California, San Diego, and the author of The Sorrows of the Empire, Militarism, Secrecy, and the End of the Republic.
I'm going to go to the bathroom. Be back in a bit.
Okay.
The Majority Report with Garofalo and Cedar. Buckle your seatbelts. We just took away their first names.
We are back on the Majority Report, Air America Radio, streaming at airamericaradio.com, blogging at majorityreportradio.com. My name is Sam Cedar. Janine is out of town. My guest co-host for tonight is David Cross.
I've been all right.
David has been, you've been more than all right. You've been okay. And on the phone, we have Chalmers Johnson. He's the president of the Japan Policy Research Institute and professor emeritus at the University of California. He is also the author of The Sorrows of Empire, Militarism, Secrecy, and the End of the Republic, and Blowback, The Costs and Consequences of the American Empire. Welcome, Chalmers.
Thank you. Congratulations on your first year.
Yes, thank you very much for joining us again. I think it's been several months, and it's always a pleasure to have you back.
I was thinking about the launch programs a year ago.
Yes. Well, thanks again. Now, tell us for our listeners who may not have heard you the last time you were on, and who may not be familiar with your book, which is a fantastic book, and in some ways a little bit depressing, with all due respect.
Yes.
Tell us about the central idea behind the book.
The first book, Blowback, was written before 9/11. It was a warning that the new century that we were just entering, it was published in early 2000, was going to be dominated by the costs of things that the United States had done abroad in the last half of the 20th century. Blowback is a CIA term. It means retaliation, but it doesn't just mean retaliation. It means retaliation for things that the Americans had done abroad that were kept totally secret from the American public, so that they are unable to put it in context, to see cause and effect when it happens. 9/11 was without doubt the best single illustration ever of blowback. The Sorrows of Empire followed it, and it was a study of American militarism. That is, the inevitable accompaniment of American imperialism is militarism, by which I do not mean the defense of the United States. I mean vested interests in the military as a way of life, in the military-industrial complex as a way of making money. Among the things I try to do in The Sorrows of Empire is lay out the empire as it exists today, well over 700 American military bases in other people's countries.
And what is the status now, I mean, of America's, I guess, imperial reach?
Oh, I think today we are well on our way toward being regarded by the entire rest of the world, much as the Roman Empire was, as a totally malignant society. That is, when a week after 9/11, George Bush went to Congress and started quoting Jesus Christ, but in his famous phrase that you're either with us or against us, he didn't also mention, he probably didn't know, that it's a phrase from the Bible that V.I. Lenin also loved a great deal, but that nonetheless, you're either with us or against us. The truth of the matter is, now in the years after, 4 years after 9/11, there are a great many more people who are against us than were in a week after 9/11. The entire Islamic world, 20% of the world's population, virtually all of our allies, regardless of what their governments say, and that this is it's a pathetic situation, that moreover the world is now accustomed to the idea that the president and the secretary of state are simply professional liars. They go around the world saying they would like to have renewed reliance on international law, on multilateral institutions, and things of this sort, whereas in fact their actions totally discredit anything along those lines. Anybody who would name John Bolton as our ambassador to the United Nations, John Negroponte, given his background as supporting the CIA in its Iran-Contra world of the 1980s, Paul Wolfowitz to the World Bank, it's not to be believed when they say that they would like to get along with other people.
So how do you think that the international community is going to react to this?
Oh, I think they're reacting already in the way they did to the Roman Empire. They begin ever so slowly, never publicly, quietly, isolating us, ostracizing us, getting rid of us. It's just simply palpable now throughout the Islamic world that, I mean, let's just remember, the Armenians are virtually defined today by their hatred of the Turks almost 100 years ago because of their genocide against Armenia. The truth of the matter is today that's going to be true of Iraqis, of Iranians, of others. They're going to hate us until the end of time for what we've done to them. And it's no time to envy the young.
Mr. Johnson, can you give us an example of how we're currently being ostracized?
Oh, I think you see it in numerous ways. Perhaps the main crisis that is brewing out there right now is our irresponsible public finance. For an empire, we have remarkably stupid economics right now. Britain, on the eve of the First World War, had huge trade and current account surpluses. We have deficits of 5% of gross domestic product in this area, and they get worse all the time. We spend $750 billion a year on one or another aspects of our military affairs, but we're not paying for it. We're asking Chinese, Japanese savers to send us money, $2 billion a day, to keep us afloat. It's simply a matter of saying for a profligate debtor, such as we are, the world's largest debtor, to continue to insult his banker is imprudent, to say the least.
All right. Well, Professor, we have to take a break. But when we come back, let's talk more about the leverage that we have given our competitors around the world against us at a time where we're being incredibly aggressive. You're listening to The Majority Report on Air America Radio. My name's Sam Cedar. I'm joined by David Cross, and we're talking to Chalmers Johnson.
The Majority Report on Air America Radio.
We are back on the Majority Report, Air America Radio, streaming at airamericaradio.com, blogging at majorityreportradio.com. My name is Sam Cedar. Janine Garofalo out of town tonight. I am joined by my guest co-host, David Cross.
Yes, sir.
Whose angry picture is up on our blog at majorityreportradio.com. On the phone, it's our pleasure to welcome back Chalmers Johnson. He is a professor emeritus at the University of California and author of The Sorrows of Empire, Militarism, Secrecy, and the End of the Republic, and Blowback, The Cost and Consequences of American Empire. And now, Chalmers, when we were at the break, we were talking about the fact that the United States has leveraged themselves incredibly to people who are theoretically our competitors in the American attempt to become an empire.
Well, I think that's true, that we it's insane to be an empire when you're not economically able to afford it, that you're like dependent on the kindness of strangers, as Tennessee Williams might have put it. These strangers include the Minister of Finance of China, who has absolutely no reason at all to care for us, except for the fact that he would like to sell in our market. This is the largest, the fastest growing large economy on Earth today. I just wrote a piece recently called "No Longer the Sole Superpower." I think it's true. The United States is not the lone superpower any longer. China is clearly emerging as one, and it would be to our advantage to adjust to them, to live with them. Instead, we're encouraging Japanese rearmament, promoting hostility over Taiwan, an ancient issue of which we intervened in the Chinese Civil War on the side of the losing nationalists. And these kinds of things, they're simply everywhere. The Chinese prime minister visits in Latin America and signs huge deals with Brazil, Argentina, Venezuela. Let me just offer you an example of the kind of leverage that's going on. Today's press from Tokyo, April 13th, in the Sankei newspaper, a major public opinion poll in Korea, that South Korea, a genuine democracy and an ally of ours. About 60% of South Koreans think that Japan and the United States are more dangerous for them than the North Koreans, even though the three countries are allies. The result of this poll, 43.8% said that the North Korean nuclear capacity would be defensive against an attack by the United States when the two parts of Korea were unified. This is not news you read in the New York Times, but it is news that's now increasingly common around the world. People preparing. I mean, Iran is a good example. It is now surrounded by the United States in Iraq, in Afghanistan, in our bases in Central Asia, such as the one in Kyrgyzstan, things of this sort. There's an awful lot of people around the world who think that the Iranians are being merely rational in developing their own nuclear weapons. It's the only way to stop the American imperialist juggernaut.
Now, Dr. Johnson, this is an interesting situation because from my, and this is speculation on my part, but it's based on a couple of things. We had, we know that the neocons have been famously worried about China for some time.
Yes.
And there were stories of Lin Chaney sitting on the commission that was looking into potential threats to America that Gary Hart chaired.
Yes.
And he was here and he told us the story of Lin Chaney coming into their first meetings and saying the biggest threat against America is China.
Yes.
And she kept saying it. They finally said, well, we think it's terrorism. And she left in disgust. And there are some people who argue that part of the reason why we went to Iraq, or maybe the main reason, was to control the spigot of oil going to the Chinese, ultimately.
Now, I think that's quite true. As China becomes, I do not believe that a fast-growing, rich, and unbelievably capitalist China is to any disadvantage of the United States. The possibilities of complementarity here are great. The world's oldest continuously extant civilization is back, and it's
and China does not seem to have very many imperialistic, intentions.
I don't believe that it does. I think that the issue we're talking about is Taiwan, which is without question a part of China. It's where the nationalist troops, Chiang Kai-shek's troops, withdrew in 1949 when they were defeated on the mainland in the Chinese Civil War. The issue of Taiwan would not exist if the Americans had not intervened at that time and guaranteed the security of Taiwan. We still do. It was an ancient issue in the Republican Party, one of the things that led to McCarthyism and the attacks on China's specialists in the State Department. It still persists. If only the American militarists would go away, the problem would largely solve itself, that the two pieces of China are integrating themselves very rapidly economically. If you would go upriver from Shanghai, up the Yangtze toward Nanjing, you'd almost think you were in Taiwan, looking at the size of the Taiwanese investments. It's an absurd situation, but indeed, people like Paul Wolfowitz and other neocon chicken hawks, to use General Zinni's term, but one that I totally agree with, characters with no experience of either war or barracks life, but who said after the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991, our policy was to make sure that no one on Earth ever had any potentiality at all of challenging us in any way.
How do you reconcile this? Let me ask you this, Dr. Johnson. How do you reconcile this notion that they perceive China as obviously as an economic threat, as a military threat, perhaps,
yes,
and as certainly as a world leader, a threat to America, hyperpowerism, if you will. But then at the same time, they allow us to become such a debtor nation and in debt to the Chinese. How do you reconcile those?
Well, by the same token, the Fortune 500 and the businessmen wing of the Republican Party are totally in bed with the Chinese. I can guarantee you without any empirical investigation whatsoever, 90% of your audience listening right now are sitting in underwear made in China. If they're not, they don't have any on at all. That's where you get it these days. China can make anything on Earth cheaper than it can be made anywhere else. And Walmart is virtually a distribution agency in this country for Chinese manufactured goods. The Chinese Minister of Foreign Affairs is much more concerned about the Vice President of Boeing for International Affairs than he is anything said by the neocons in Washington, since most Boeing airplane products are manufactured in China and then assembled in Washington, in the state of Washington. It is a major conundrum. It reflects the two contradictory forces within the Republican Party, one military and imperialist, the other industrial and globalist, and one of the things we're waiting for is to see the shoe to drop between them. The costs to the United States of any kind of military conflict with China are simply enormous, in that China, differing from Japan and other rich countries in East Asia, has gotten rich among other things, foreign direct investment. It is the largest absorber of foreign direct investment, that is, foreign-owned factories manufacturing in China. It's the third largest country after the United States and Britain in this area. If this should be cut off, these people lose their manufacturing ability overnight. Therefore, the whole thing is crazy that we continue to listen to this drumbeat of propaganda about the dangers of China. We ought to be adjusting to China, and if we did so, it would greatly encourage our security and our economic well-being.
We're talking to Dr. Chalmers Johnson. He's the author of The Sorrows of the Empire, Militarism, Secrecy, and the End of the Republic, and Blowback, the Costs and Consequences of American Empire. It's interesting because this dichotomy that you're talking about between the neocons and the industrialists, is also manifested in a story that Greg Palast told us about the plans for Iraqi oil prior to the invasion and occupation.
Well, I think there's no doubt about that, yeah.
That where there was the big oil companies actually wanted the Iraqis to retain ownership of their oil so that they could simply have a straw dog there or some type of a front man, and they could get the oil that way, and it was sort of quieter and more subtle and more genteel. And the neocons wanted to completely privatize the oil.
Well, thanks to Donald Rumsfeld, nobody's getting any oil from Iraq. And so, therefore, we're thinking of invading Iran. We've just had the Israeli prime minister visiting our president to more or less give him orders from the Israeli lobby in this country that we don't like Iran. We also need Iranian oil. It's the second largest source of oil on Earth after Saudi Arabia. It also has the capacity to close.
It's the second largest after Saudi Arabia as opposed to Iraq? Or is Iraq just has bigger reserves?
Third. Iraq is then third.
Okay.
It has the capacity at the head of the Persian Gulf to close the Persian Gulf at the Straits of Hormuz. But at the same time, Iran today feels threatened. It's been threatened by the United States since 1953 when we overthrew their government, Prime Minister Mohammad Mossadegh, for the interests of the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company, now British Petroleum. We then brought to power one of the most repressive regimes in the Middle East, namely the Shah of Iran, who was overthrown in 1979. This brought Ayatollah Khomeini to power. The result then is we supported our asset and the person that Donald Rumsfeld liked so much he flew off to talk with, namely Saddam Hussein, throughout a bloody war in the 1980s. It just goes on and on and on, and that one could imagine. I mean, that is, there are plenty of people on Earth who understand the fix Iran is in, and that their policies of trying to defend themselves with nuclear weapons make sense.
And do you think that an attack on Iran is imminent?
We certainly hear enough about it, enough chit-chat from the Cheney and Cheney-type minds that dominate our government, that I think it would be simply impossible today, in light of the ease with which the president lies about these issues and what he actually did do in Iraq and the world of false intelligence sold to the American public. It is impossible to say that that's not coming, and it might be coming in June.
What form do you think that is going to take? How is that going to happen?
Well, I think it would mean that we would declare that things are okay in Iraq. It's over. Therefore, we use our army in Iraq to invade Iran.
Now, I know that Scott Ritter has said that there is that he has heard that there have been plans.
He said
for
June.
Yes.
Yeah, he said June.
He said June. That's the figure. And Scott Ritter, he's like Cassandra. He has a bad record of being right.
Yes, and often. I just have one more question for you. This is actually coming from the blog, and it's a nice summary. The question is posed, Dr. Johnson, please comment on writers like Niall Ferguson and Walter Russell Mead, who seem to think that an unapologetic empire is not such a bad idea for the U.S.
Well, again, it's simply boring listening to English expatriates. Niall Ferguson is a Scot who has been hired by the not-great genius president of Harvard University these days, it is in their history department, who loves to sit around and talk about the beauties of the British Empire. He would never mention Indian partition, the Andaman Islands as a prison colony, the concentration camps of the Boer War, or anything else. You cannot make a case that British imperialism or any imperialism is pretty. Russell Mead represents the Council on Foreign Relations. That's the establishment. These are propagandists whose function is to think of clever ideas to defend the American Empire. I'm terribly sorry to say, in fact, what is now coming through to the rest of the world is that we appear daily as a malignant force, not the public, but our government, protected by unimaginable secrecy, by a totally irresponsible private army in the hands of the president called the Central Intelligence Agency, by a Congress that is worthless. But the truth of the matter is, if they wanted to be honest, they couldn't do oversight on the Department of Defense anyway, since 40% of the Pentagon's budget is black, is secret. I'm sorry to say, the crumbling of the structure of our republic bestowed in our Constitution that is now being replaced by an imperial presidency.
Well, Dr. Johnson, thank you so much for joining us.
Glad to be cheerful tonight on your program.
Yes, well, it's always heartening to see what's going on there. We appreciate it very much.
Thank you. I admire what you're doing.
The books Sorrow of Empire, Militarism, Secrecy, and the End of the Republic, and Blowback, The Costs of Consequences of American Empire. They're both amazing reads, and they're available. They should be on the Air America Radio book site. We'll be right back with David Cross.
The Majority Report with Janine Garofalo and Sam Cedar.
What is the matter with you people?
Quiet, numbskulls. I'm broadcasting.
On Air America Radio.
We are back on the Majority Report, Air America Radio. Streaming at airamericaradio.com, blogging at majorityreportradio.com. My name is Sam Cedar, here with guest co-host David Cross. David, help me land this baby, will you?
Sweet, sweet, sweet metaphor. I see your show as a silver bird, another metaphor, like an aeroplane.
That's it?
Oh, do you literally help you land it?
Yeah, no, literally.
Oh,
help me land
I'm sorry.
This baby. We gotta take this baby into port, if you know what I mean.
Oh, now it's a seaplane. You're really coming at me from every angle.
Oh, yeah, buddy.
You know, in an addendum to what Chalmers Johnson was saying, the one good thing about British imperialism turn of the 20th century was we got some good literature out of it. I don't think Rudyard Kipling would really, I think he might take offense to that. And that's the thing that I hope for during the demise of the American Empire is that we get some good literature out of it and some hilarious TV sitcoms, I'm sure, are coming. If you've seen Life on a Stick, you know what I'm talking about. You know, and let's...
What is Life on a Stick?
It's a very funny new Fox show. I'm assuming it's funny. It's on Fox. Very funny show. About some kids who work at a mall, and it's like a hot dog and a stick thing, and it just looks wonderful and enlightening.
Well, there you have it.
Yeah, there I do have it. There you have it. There you have it, America.
There I have it.
There you have it, America.
Well, actually, you forgot Poland.
Oh, yeah, speaking of Poland, yeah. David, Poland will withdraw its 1,700 troops from Iraq after the U.N. mandate expires at the end of
this year.
Must
be an election coming up there.
Ooh,
I'm taking
right.
a guess. Really?
Poland is the fourth largest contributor of troops in the U.S.-led coalition.
Folks, if a country is pulling their troops out of the coalition, it means there's an election coming up in that country.
That's right. I mean, people don't like their troops being there.
And they don't like America.
And, you know, I'll tell you something, David, apropos of that, there is no election coming up here, which is why Donald Rumsfeld, who went to Iraq, said the U.S. has no exit strategy. We don't have an exit strategy. We have a victory strategy. And that is to come up with pithy sayings.
Yes.
Like, we don't have an exit strategy.
And
we have a victory strategy.
And you or I will not live to see the day of that victory strategy, but or the
exit strategy.
Parade. Well, let's call it a victory strategy.
You know, there was actually, I don't know where Stephen is, but
we're going to be victorious around 2069.
What was that headline that Josh, that was on that site? What was the site?
Oh, he said Rumsfeld went to Iraq, returns, leaves troops.
We had a pullout. One troop, Donald Rumsfeld. And meanwhile, the Associated Press reported yesterday that tens of thousands of supporters of a militant Shiite cleric filled central Baghdad streets Saturday and demanded that American soldiers go home, marking the second anniversary of Baghdad's fall with shouts of no, no to Satan. That being...
Yeah, well, they were also distributing candy and flowers, rose petals, to the troops while they were saying that. Let's tell both sides of the story. Also, it wasn't simply the streets.
Tens of thousands.
Listen to me, Sam. It wasn't simply the streets that they gathered in. They gathered in the exact square where the Saddam Hussein toppling of the statue photo op took place.
They burned the U.S. flag as well as cardboard cutouts of Bush and Saddam. They're now equating the U.S. with Saddam. Three effigies representing Saddam, Bush, and Prime Minister Tony Blair, all handcuffed and dressed in red Iraqi prison jumpsuits.
See, now how come they don't tell you the good news?
Yeah.
How come they don't tell you? They're up in, you know, they get on TV, New York Times or Jew Glork Blimes, as I like to call it. You know, doesn't get up there. They don't tell you the good news. They don't tell you that news either. But they also don't tell you the good news. They're not telling you any news. That's my point.
Tomorrow,
there's no news!
Tomorrow, Tariq Ali, author of Street Fighting Years. And Atreos from the blog Eschaton. David Cross, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Get her done!
Give us some peaches, if you will.
Excuse me?
Will you say peaches?
Peaches.
We'll talk to you tomorrow night!
The Majority Report.